Chapter 10 Rizpah. I am a broken woman. I am broken in body, I am broken in spirit, and I am completely broken in heart. I have also finally become very old, very quickly. Thankfully, Mephibosheth sees to it that I have food to eat and a very nice place to live. He's such a fine man, so much like his wonderful father Jonathan, except of course for his twisted feet. His son Micah has proven himself to be a grand man and a true friend, in spite of who he looks like. David, the king of Israel, has offered to take care of me, but as long as I live, I hope I never see that man again, and would starve before taking so much as a crumb from his table. Now, if he offered me the crumb from his hand to my lips, I would take it, so I could take off a couple of fingers with what teeth I have left. No, I am an old, broken, white-haired woman who simply sits and waits for the moment when I can go to be with my sons and my parents, and where God can finally give me rest and peace to my soul. Not all that long ago, I was not really old, and was certainly not broken. My life has not been easy, contrary to what people might believe, but I refused to let it break me down. I continued to keep my head high and my back straight, and my hair somehow stayed pretty much black. But in a few months' time, all of that was gone, and here I am, old and broken and white-headed. I used to be tall, and so I've been told 1,000 times, quite beautiful. Even when in my 50s, I somehow had the ability to turn men's heads. When I was 10 years younger, I could stop them in their tracks. When in my 30s, I would leave them gaping. When in my 20s, they could not take their eyes off me. When in my late teens, their jaws would most often fall open. I know that what I am about to say sounds almost impossible, but in spite of my beauty and the gaping men, somehow, thankfully, almost all the women around me in my life really liked me, and most even loved me. The reason for this was, and again, whether you believe it or not, I kept myself chaste, was never flirtatious, and worked hard to be kind to every one of them. The truth of the matter is that I wanted to be known and remembered as a good woman, and not a beautiful one. But in the end, who knows what I'll be remembered for, if I'm remembered at all. Right now, I know what I am known for, Saul's concubine, and, oh God, help me, the mother whose sons King David turned over to the Gibeonites to be hung from trees like rotting animals. This latter event is what turned me into the old, physically wrecked and broken-hearted woman. While I pray that God will ever bless my kind, sweet Mephibosheth, I wish he'd just let me die. I was born and raised in the very small village of Tamith, not too far from Gezer, and about a day's journey north from Gibeah. When I turned 16, my parents were about to enter into arrangements for me to marry a local boy, who was the son of a livestock merchant named Nabathinium. Nabathinium's son was 18, and his name was Jehaleb. I was the prettiest girl in the village and was considered the catch, while Jehaleb was its handsome young man. From the time we were small children, we'd been close friends, and from the time I was 13, we both knew that eventually we'd marry. I talked about it to my mother, and Jehaleb talked about it to his father, and both our parents informed us that it had pretty well already been taken care of. When I turned 16, the time for the formal dowry negotiations had arrived. Nothing was settled as yet, but all knew the time was at hand and the actual process would take no longer than a week. The word was out that our parents were going into talks, and this excited the entire village. The excitement came to abrupt end, however, the day that King Saul and a large company of his men came through our village. Then a new excitement hit town, and the talk was just really getting started. And it continued on and off for the next half century. It's hard to imagine how quickly the news that the king was in town spread. It was like a fire in a dry barley field. Seemingly, within minutes, the entire populace was in the street, waving and screaming their accolades to the young, handsome, powerful king and his solemn entourage of warriors. As for me, I was excited as everyone else. For most of us, especially the women, it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to actually see someone really important, let alone the king. I was with three of my best friends, and we found ourselves jumping up and down and squealing as excitedly as the children. Actually, this really was pretty silly, seeing that most girls our age were already married and had at least one child. But still, something this exhilarating to take place in Tamworth was very rare indeed. The king's company moved slowly and finally stopped in the middle of the village square. The king then began leaning down from his saddle to shake the hands of the elders of our community. That he did not dismount let us know that he was not planning to stay and was, no doubt, just passing through. Men of note, one after another from our entire region, how did they get here so quickly? Vied for his attention, however brief it might be. After shaking literally dozens of these eager hands, the king finally straightened himself upright and stretched, even as he kept his hands on the saddle. At this, we figured that his time was up and would soon be moving on. King Saul smiled, began waving in all directions to the adoring crowd, glanced in the direction of me and my girlfriends, waved, turned his massive horse and his back on us, and began moving away. He kept on waving, and then he stopped still. The king then lowered his arm, turned back around in his saddle, and began searching the crowd for something or someone. We could not imagine what had arrested his attention, but he kept it up, slowly turning his horse around, apparently trying to keep it from stepping on those who were thronging him. When he had finally turned completely around, his squinting eyes inspected, as it were, each face. Then, his eyes rested on me. That's when he stopped searching and began to stare, and stare, and stare. I began to look around to see if it was me that he was staring at, and it was. My girlfriends realized this as well, and for some reason began to distance themselves a little from me, as if perhaps I was in trouble, and the last thing they wanted was to be in trouble, especially with the all-powerful King of Israel. By now, everyone realized something was up, and the crowd began to quiet down, perhaps in order to hear what was happening, seeing as how they could not make out what it was by sight. But those nearest me could make it out, and their eyes were shifting back and forth from the king to myself and back to the king. Once again, Saul leaned down in his saddle, took an eagerly extended hand, pulled the man to him, and began speaking quietly but earnestly to him. The man was an elder of our village named Demzagi. He was not the most prominent man of the village, but he was within, say, the top 10. At that moment, however, and for the next several years, he immediately moved to the number 1 spot. I saw Demzagi look my way, stare at me curiously, and then spoke into the king's ear. The king never took his eyes off me, even though I had, no doubt, turned beet red and had begun to tremble. He spoke again to Damzagi, who turned from the king, looked at me once more, and then began to scan the crowd, and then, to my horror, loudly cry out the name of my father. "Aiyah! Aiyah, son of Aroni, where are you? Aiyah, come here quickly. Someone find me, Aiyah." Everyone in the crowd immediately buzzed with excitement and began searching around them to see if my father was near. Fortunately for my heart, which was about to beat out of my chest, my father came, well, was actually all but carried by four men within less than a minute. My father was not struggling with them and could easily have walked, but no doubt the men wished to seem important to the king, as if they alone had apprehended a felon of some sort. My father was anything but a felon, but at that moment he did have a very apprehensive look upon his face. My mother, who was working her way through the crowd behind the men, wore instead a look of dread. When father was released next to Saul's stirrup, King Saul smoothly dismounted and leaned down to talk to him. He had to look down for two reasons. The first was that King Saul was head and shoulders taller than my father. I received my height from my mother's side of the family. And secondly, he apparently did not want everyone to hear what he was discussing. I saw my father turn slowly towards me. His eyes were open very wide, and he had acquired a dazed expression. My mother, never a shy woman, stood next to my father and began quizzing him. It took him a few moments to realize that she was talking to him, what's new, but presently he began to whisper in her ear. Then I saw her eyes grow wide and watched her slowly look up into the king's face. He was standing erect, with his arms folded, staring at me with a smile on his face. At that moment, I saw someone else working his way through the crowd. It was the handsomest young man in Tamith, the young man who, this time next week, was supposed to be espoused to me. He had no doubt heard that something was up with the king and the family of Aiyah, and always, being such a fine, brave boy, had decided to find out what it was. I took notice that Jehaleb's father, Nabathinium, was not with him. Jehaleb bowed low to the king, who did not take note of him. He was still staring at me, and then he began conversing back and forth with my parents. Then I saw Jehaleb turn in my direction. His face was pale, his eyes were wide open as well, and his lips were parted as if he were trying to speak. He slowly began shaking his head back and forth, and I saw him begin to cry. To the amazement of everyone, the king then unfolded his massive arms and began walking toward me. He left Jehaleb, my parents, the soldiers, and his horse, and made his way directly to me. He stopped a mere foot away and stared down at me. I was tall, but not nearly as tall as he, who was, but I was too frightened to look up. I was also trembling like a leaf in the wind and was not sure how much longer I could even keep standing. He then, for the very first of a thousand times, spoke my name. Rizpah. I was frightened, amazed, pleased, and yet displeased, all at the same time. But I made my trembling voice say, "Yes, my lord." In the background, I could hear Jehaleb give a loud groan of anguish as he began tearing his way through the crowd as if to escape. I didn't see this, as Saul was so large and so close that there was no seeing around him, but still, I knew what was happening with and to Jehaleb. "Rizpah," he said again, in a quiet, gentle tone. But this time, as he uttered it, he was lifting my chin with his forefinger and thumb. "I am going to take you to live with me in my palace in Gibeon. Do you understand? But I don't want to live there. I don't want to leave here. I am about to be married here. No, my dear, you are not espoused. Nothing was finalized. You are free. You are free to come with me. I have already told your father and mother, and the dowry being paid to them is far, far more than they would ever receive from anyone else. Furthermore, they will have it by the morning light, and at that time you and I will be on our way to Gibeah. Am I going to be your wife? I asked, now trembling more than ever, and my eyes darting into and out of his. Well, let's just say that you're going to be mine. Now I begin to groan and cry. A servant? Is that what I'm going to be? A servant? A slave? No, no, never, my dear Rizpah. You're going to have servants, servants that will wait upon you and you alone. But I want to stay here. Don't you want to come and see my palace, see where I live, to see the beautiful house and lands where you're going to live? My king, I want to live here. I've never been away from here. I know, but you will love it, Rizpah, and from time to time your parents can come and see you, and you can sometimes go to see them. Also, who knows, maybe they will want to move to Gibeah and be near you. If they do, I will make sure that they have a beautiful farm and a beautiful home. At this, all I could do was bury my face in my hands and sob. I then felt my mother's arms sweep around me and we wailed together. I then heard the king call for a man named Abner, who I came to find out was the captain of all the armies of Israel. He ordered Abner to set up camp on the south side of the city, the side closest to Gibeah. Before he turned to go, Abner and I, for the briefest of moments, locked eyes. Mine were full of tears and his were full of curiosity, and I think, as I look back, a little awe, and most importantly, compassion. The king then walked back to my father to speak again to him. Presently I heard my father pleading with him about something, and then heard Saul's voice raised rather loudly. All right then, one last night. I then could make out no other sounds than that of my mother's wails and the wails of my friends who had gathered back around me. I'm not even sure if they knew why they were crying, but girls can be like that. So, I spent my last night with my parents in Tamath. It was a solemn affair with lots of tears. Family members, friends, and the ever-nosy arrived from within the village and around the countryside, coming and going, questioning, laughing, and weeping. My father kept trying to put the best possible spin on the matter with phrases like, "Just think, our Rizpah, she will live like a queen." Only to have my mother hiss back, "But she'll not be a queen, and never ever will be, and you know it." Then they would both tear up, and many would weep yet once again. Late in the night, after all the family and all the friends and all of the nosy rumor gatherers had gone or been sent home, and when my parents no doubt thought I was asleep, I heard my father say, "You know, the aged one, the prophet Samuel, he tried to warn us. He tried to warn us what our king would be like." "Yes, he did," Mother replied, "and this is just the beginning." Then she cried some more. After a while, I heard her say, "Aiya, what are we going to tell everyone? And what shall I tell Mikib and Rohai? Really, what can I say?" Mikib and Rohai were my two older brothers that had been out on their own for a few years. Both of them were married, had several children, and were trying to eke out existences on their small farms. Come on, Kara, these kind of arrangements have been going on for centuries. Fiercely, my mother answered, but not in my family, Aaya, not in my family. I know, he weakly replied, as they both fell silent. After a long while, I heard, Kara? Yes. For now, let's just tell them that the king took her to Gibeah to be a confectionery. Aaya, my mother sighed, if he was to take Yobed's daughter or Zakev's daughter, everyone would believe that. There's not one person in the world that has ever laid eyes on our Rizpah who will believe that Saul took her to live in his house to bake sweets. No, I guess not. Then I heard my mother weep some more. Somehow, my mother and father finally went to sleep for whatever was left of the night. As for me, until the sun came up, I could do nothing but think about them, and about my poor Jehaleb, and about my village, and about Gibeah, and the palace, and about King Saul. The next morning I left my home, moved into the king's palace, and became one of his five concubines. Within 5 years I bore King Saul two daughters and a son. I also became his favorite concubine. I lived well and was as happy as could be expected. Both my rooms and my view were beautiful. My bedroom window faced east, and I saw many dazzling sunrises come up over the glorious hills. My children, of course, brought me my greatest joy, and I had two servants to help me with my children, as well as my other needs. As for my parents, I had seen them only twice. In order for that to happen, they had come to Gibeah. Whenever I brought up the subject of my going to see them, Saul would redden, tell me I must have too much idle time on my hands and that if they really loved me, they'd come here. This speech always reminded me somewhat of Pharaoh's speech to Moses. They are idle, the people are idle. But I would let that observation slide. I had learned quickly that an intelligent person simply did not cross the word of King Saul. In fact, with each passing year, he seemed to grow worse in both obstinacy and dourness. There were many speculations, quietly whispered, about his degenerating mental outlook and increasingly foul moods. Most blamed the king's condition on David, the young man that had taken the hearts of Israel by storm. His killing of the giant Goliath was only the beginning of his fame. This spectacular feat was followed by one magnificent military exploit after another. Within 3 short years, he had become the king's son-in-law, marrying Saul's youngest daughter, Michal. In truth, King Saul had a host of younger daughters, but as these were not the children of Queen Ahinoam, well, they just didn't count. That was the price one paid for being a child of the king, but a child of one of his concubines. From my vantage point, however, I could not see that being queen meant all that much either. In truth, there was not a one of us, concubines that is, that would trade places with Saul's for real wife for anything. Not if it meant being treated as she was. Shelia once said that the phrase treated like a dog must have been coined for Ahinoam. Shelia was a beautiful woman and fellow concubine, though several years older than myself. She'd been brought to Gibeah several years before I had arrived, and her story was nothing like mine. But it revealed just how vulnerable most any woman could be when in the hands of an uncaring, uncouth man. She also became my closest friend and confidant. Shelia, had been given to King Saul as a present by a shrewd and prosperous businessman who lived in Jabesh-Gilead. Jabesh-Gilead was a city that Saul, a couple of years after he became king, had delivered from the cruel hands of Nahash, the king of Ammon. A few years after delivering the city, the businessman, whose name was Jehozadad, had obtained Shaliah from a former business partner named Zokiah, to whom he had lent a considerable amount of money. The date of repayment came and went with no payment, so Jehozadad went to Zokiah's house to foreclose on the loan. Due to his inability to pay the loan, the frightened former partner offered Jehozadad a newly obtained servant girl in lieu of payment. As she was indeed a very beautiful girl, Jehozadad accepted her, with terms. Zokiah had obtained the girl by foreclosing on a failing farmer. The farmer, a rather lazy character, had inherited a profitable farm from a widowed uncle who had no children. But the farmer, through great laziness, had reduced it to an absolute wreck. When the lazy farmer could not pay his loan, Zokiah took the lazy farmer's daughter instead of the farm that now wasn't worth much and looked horrible. But the girl indeed did not look horrible. She was beautiful. He also took two mules and a cow, though they were in the farm's condition, not the girl's. Now, finding himself in his own bind, Zokiah, the former partner of Jehozadad, offered him this beautiful, untouched servant girl. Jehozadad did not accept her for the cost of the loan, but he did take possession of her and put off the due date of the loan for 3 more years. Zokiah agreed and learned yet one more lesson in shrewd business dealings from his former partner. As for Jehozadad, he now had a beautiful young lady to add to his collection of merchandise that he was gathering in copious amounts. Before doing anything with her, Jehozadad heard of King Saul's latest and greatest victory over the Philistines at Michmash. In actuality, it was Jonathan who had won the day, but still, King Saul received the credit, even though he almost had Jonathan slain afterward for eating some honey. Few people ever completely understood what that was all about, but they did understand one thing. No one, not even Saul's own son, was allowed to break a commandment of King Saul. The only one who seemed to have the luxury of breaking Saul's word was Saul himself. But, back to our story. In appreciation to the king for his many wonderful exploits, Jehozadad decided to give Shaliah to the king as a present. In doing so, he immediately expanded his business opportunities all the way into the region of Benjamin, and more importantly, into the upper echelons of Israel's government. King Saul, being taken by the girl's beauty, decided that he did not need another servant, of which he already had plenty, so he made Shaliah one of his earliest concubines. When Zokiah, the former business partner of Jehozadad, heard about what had happened, he realized how far behind he was in real business acumen. When the lazy farmer heard about where his daughter had ended up, he was absolutely thrilled and found himself quite often coming to see his beloved daughter that he so desperately missed and that now lived in the king's palace and fared so sumptuously. This he did until he wore out his welcome and King Saul had him, quite literally, thrown out the back door. Shaliah, sick of being a pawn for lazy, greedy, unscrupulous, and licentious men, was actually glad to be in the king's palace and to sleep under a non-leaking roof that would not be repossessed anytime soon. She had lived here for many years and knew the ropes. It was this woman that befriended and tutored me on court etiquette. What this means is, she taught me the ropes, informing me what closets held what skeletons, where the bones were buried, and of which people to steer clear. At any rate, Shaliah and I, and most everyone else who was close to the situation, noticed that the higher David's star rose, the deeper Saul's spirit sank. And that didn't make any sense whatsoever. As far as we could see, we being Shaliah, me and the other concubines that dared whisper our thoughts to each other, David was completely and painstakingly loyal to Saul. More than that, Saul's oldest son, Jonathan, who idolized his father, had grown closer to David than to his own brothers. As for David, he was closer to Jonathan than he ever thought of being to his own kith and kin, two of which were becoming quite well known. They were nephews of David, quite young as well, but were proving themselves to be fearsome warriors. One's name was Joab, and his younger brother was named Abishai. Between the captain of the host, Abner, King Saul's son, Jonathan, and David, a captain of thousands, Israel subdued everything and everybody. The skirmishes and battles that took place were quickly entered into and thoroughly won. All three of these men were kind and respectful to me, and were so as well to the other women. Jonathan even went so far as to name his son Mephibosheth after my second son that I gave birth to in my sixth year at Gibeah. Of course, Jonathan didn't make this common knowledge, and Saul certainly lent it no weight. But I knew it was true, for Jonathan once said to me, "Rizpah, I always thought that you named Mephibosheth very well. For reasons of my own, I gave my son the same name." His words have always meant so much to me, especially in light of what has since happened to both of us. The name Mephibosheth means to dispel shame. No one in the kingdom was kinder to me than Abner. Sometimes he would seek me out and give me warning as to when to lie low in those seasons when the king was in a particularly ill humor. His advice was duly taken and acted upon. I always shared Abner's warnings with Shaliah, and even gave thought to sharing these informational tidbits concerning the king's mood with Queen Ahinoam herself. The reason I pondered this was that my heart did go out to her. But I could not bring myself to do it, for any time I'd go near the woman, she would turn to stone, or perhaps it was ice. I'd been Saul's concubine for 2 months before I was introduced to Ahinoam, and immediately became convinced that regardless of how hard I might try, it would be a miracle if I could ever befriend the poor woman. I personally don't ever recall seeing so much pain and hatred in one set of eyes. To this day, my heart still breaks for her, though she's been dead for many, many years. When I think of the madness that eventually engulfed her, I could just cry. But then, these days, I cry over almost anything. I was in Gibeah a full year before I found out that Abner was King Saul's uncle, though you'd never have guessed it by the age or mannerisms of either. When I asked Shaliah why she didn't tell me, she said, "Well, you and Abner are such confidants, I just took it for granted that you knew." As I said, I had another son, and what a fine, strong, bright, good-looking boy he was. In fact, both were. Either one of them would have been better kings than Saul, Ishbosheth, or David put together. I also had another beautiful daughter. Actually, all three of my daughters are beautiful, if I do say it myself. The first girl married many years ago and married very well. Thank God. As for the last two son-in-laws, I'm withholding judgment on one, and the other is an absolute loser. Fortunately, all five children had both Saul and my good looks, and none of Saul's morose, cynical ways. For that last fact, I have thanked God 1,000 times. It is painful and sad that the girl that married well lives far away. The son-in-law that married my second daughter, the one I'm holding my breath over, works the lands of Prince Adonijah. This is but the latest in a long line of jobs he has held. The son-in-law, the one I abhor, that married my youngest daughter, Deborah, lives less than a furlong away. Whenever I do see my beautiful daughter, she is almost always in tears. But even that tends to work out. She thinks I'm crying with her, when in actuality, I'm just using it for another excuse to weep for my sons and for myself. After King Saul's tragic death, not one of us of the House of Saul knew what the future held for any of us. We concubines, who now at least were not afraid of talking out loud amongst ourselves, that is, could see a thousand different scenarios easily coming to pass. The one we feared the most was of David coming and slaying us all. We all knew how deeply Saul had hated David and how cruel he'd been to him. Saul lived and taught merciless vengeance, and we now feared that David, who could finally quit running, would start slaying Saul's house in kind. When we heard that the tribe of Judah had made him their king, we figured it would be just a matter of a few weeks before he marshaled his forces and came to claim his pound of flesh. That's when we all ran and hid ourselves and our children in a mountain cave, like David used to. But oh, thank God, Abner rose up and saved the day. Out of all but smoking ruins, he plucked the kingdom. First, he had Saul's son Ishbosheth crowned king of Israel. Then he regrouped the army and set the world in order. Most touching of all, as far as I was concerned, was that time he came to our hiding place in the mountains, checked on our welfare, fed us, and told us that he'd be taking us home very soon. He then took me aside personally, asked about each of my children by name, and assured me that he'd personally see to it that I and my children would be safe. When we finally returned to the palace, he assigned us our rooms, giving me the very best, as well as an extra servant. We had no idea what King Ishbosheth thought about all of this, as we certainly were not, nor were we going to be, his concubines. But the truth is, we never heard a word from him. In fact, it seemed that almost all edicts and instructions being sent throughout the nation, except for Judah, of course, were issuing forth from Abner rather than the king. We attributed this to Ishbosheth's inexperience and relative youth as compared to Abner's vast experience and age. At any rate, it seemed to work. David, and whatever designs he had on Israel, were kept at bay. But for all of Abner's hard work, things just couldn't seem to go well for the nation. Whenever I'd see Abner, he always seemed so very tired and looked as if he were carrying the entire world upon his shoulders. In spite of all he had to do, he always took the time to look after me and the needs of my children. Furthermore, he did something that Saul never did. He spent time with my sons. He taught them, or saw to it that they were taught, all the arts of war, as well as farming, business, and the proper handling of money. Well, I guess you probably guess where it all ended up. Abner and I, before he died, became involved. I know that I stated that I kept myself a chaste woman, and I really did, except for Abner. But he was better to me than Saul ever dreamed of being, except for my first month at Gibeah, and was always faithful to anything he ever promised me. I'm not making excuses for what happened, but I do want, if possible, for those that look back on my life to understand it, hopefully, just a little better. At any rate, the relationship didn't last long between us, actually less than a month. David arose to strike terror and to break my heart. David's nephew and captain, the cruel, ruthless Joab, murdered my Abner. When my sons heard what happened, they wept for the loss of Abner much more than they ever did for their own father. And just for the record, King Saul and Abner, the captain of the host of Israel, were the only two men I've known that way in my life. As calamity begets calamity, King Ishbosheth was slain within a month of Abner's death. Then it was all over for Israel, at least as we had known it. I know there are rumors that Abner had been turning from Ishbosheth to David, but as for me and my fellow ex-concubines, not a one of us believe it. We also know that if Abner had lived long enough, Ishbosheth would have died of old age as king of Israel. As it was, our fears were renewed all over again. What was going to become of us? Many a night Shaliah and I would hold each other and tremble. That is, when I wasn't holding my youngest daughter. My prayer was that perhaps I'd be allowed to return to my mother's home. My father had died 4 years before and had left my mother very well off. He had parlayed the tremendous dowry that King Saul had paid for me into handsome profits that had multiplied many times over throughout the years. My mother sent word to me several times that I could come home any time and bring anyone along that needed a place to stay. To say that her words were comforting is a vast understatement. However, there were a few problems with that option. I had two much older brothers that hardly knew me, and vice versa. What they did know of me, they seemed to abhor. As case in point, my oldest brother had spent a vast portion of the last 30 years calling me the king's whore. He finally quit saying it around my father after my father knocked him across the room and out the front door. After my father died, my brother repeated the words only once more in my mother's hearing. She promptly all but knocked him senseless with a leg of a rather large lamb that had not been cooked. All of this was very gratifying to me personally, but it didn't exactly endear me to my brother, who had received the vast majority of my parents' estate upon my aged mother's death. If I and my remaining two children, and especially Shaliah, were to run to my aged mother and she was to die, we'd be at the mercy of my brothers. My oldest brother, who would control the inheritance, absolutely abhorred me. The sad thing was that they didn't even really know me or ever give me a chance. Abner was dead. Ishbosheth was dead, and the palace was in utter chaos, awaiting word from whom? Saul had no more sons but my two boys, and not one person in Israel except Abner would give them the time of day, let alone make them king. So I was back to where I was 7 years ago after Saul died, filled with fear and contemplating fleeing to the mountains once again. Heartbreakingly, I knew that this time there'd be no Abner to come and rescue me. As for my precious sons, my oldest, Armoni, who had recently married, immediately sent me word to come and bring my children who were still with me. But I was not about to bring any more attention to that dear boy than he'd already had, especially in this regicidal climate. Then I had my mind made up for me. All Israel arose and made David their king. My children and I had no choice but to flee back to Tamath and my mother's home. I begged Shaliah to come with me, but she would not hear of it. When I asked her what she was going to do, she would just give me a well-fed cat smile and say, "Trust me, Rizzi, old Shaliah is going to be okay." I didn't see or hear from her again for well over 2 decades. My wonderful mother, thankfully, lived 20 more years. During my first 5 years with her, I was thankful to see my youngest daughter married, even if her husband is a fool. My youngest son, Mephibosheth, married a wonderful young lady, even if she is a Moabite. Armoni consoled me by reminding me that even King David's great-grandmother was a Moabite. And look, Mom, David's king. I sometimes wonder if my sons even remember who their father was. With my children married and settled after my mother passed, all I had left to really worry about was myself. My beauty had all but faded, at least in my opinion, but still I carried myself well, was healthy, and amazingly had very few gray hairs. During my mother's funeral, while I listened to my oldest brother extol the great woman and speak long and loud about her extremely high standards of moral virtue, I found myself wondering what my portion of the inheritance would be. 3 days after the funeral, my oldest brother threw me out. The excuse that Mikab used was that whereas Israel was in a great drought, he just didn't see how he could sustain me, as well as his family and all of the servants. He also stated that he was sure I would be okay financially, what with, you know, being the king's... What exactly do they call a woman that's not married and yet has a man's children? That is when I finally slapped my oldest brother, and he proceeded to knock me out cold. Still, it was worth it. To his credit, Mikab gave me a horse and 3,000 shekels. His wife had to make him do it. To his cursed shame, I knew that my share of the inheritance, even if I am a woman and not the firstborn son, should have been at least 10 times that. I was actually considering trying to contest it with a judge, but decided not to fight it when, as I was riding away, he screamed, "Goodbye, Queen Whore!" I knew that a trial would be just too ugly. As I heard him laughing in the distance, I deeply wished that Abner were still alive. It would have been his last laugh. One thing my brother was right about, however, was that Israel was in very deep trouble due to the ongoing drought. The dreaded word famine was being used more and more, and food prices were absolutely frightening. Just keeping my horse alive, I knew, would be a grievous expense. I also knew that my 3,000 shekels would barely last a year if the drought continued. So, where does a single woman of my age go? And what in the world was I to do in the face of famine? I refused to be a burden to my children, though they had all asked for me to come. Perhaps I was too proud, but unless absolutely forced to live with them, I determined to go my own way. In all of my reasonings, I wondered if Saul's stubbornness did not, alas, have an effect on me. While pondering this, I thought of a place to go. In fact, I began to long to go there. Outside of Tamith, it was the only place I'd ever known. I rode back to Gibeah, King Saul's Gibeah. I rented a small room from a farmer and his wife that had 5 small children. Thankfully, word did not quickly spread that an old woman that used to be Saul's concubine was back in town. For this, I was greatly relieved. What the family charged me was exorbitant, but it was the cheapest housing I could find, and when I saw how desperately they needed the money, I really didn't mind. I'd lived most of my life anyway, and this couple and their babies needed all the help they could get. Before the drought hit, they had done well. Now the farmer and his entire family looked like scarecrows. To say that they were thankful for the income I added would be like saying that they might be thankful for rain. I told them my name was Rizzi and tried to avoid any questions that would give away my past life in Gibeah as King Saul's concubine. I lived in Gibeah for almost 5 months, enjoying my anonymity, when the inevitable happened. As I made my way through what was left of the market in order to purchase some barley grain, I found myself being stared at by an old, somewhat decrepit man. I began to get a little nervous that perhaps the poor old thing might have gone over the edge due to the starvation specter, and that he might try to rob me. I knew better than to carry anything but the minimum amount of money I needed, and had the rest of my quickly diminishing shekels safely hidden away. But still, who needed trauma like this, especially in these dark days? So I avoided his eyes and acted as if I was not in the least alarmed. But as I made my way through the pitiful booths that were once a great marketplace, I noted that he kept getting closer and closer. I guess I had lived too many years with Saul to put up with this kind of treatment, for I finally spun around and said, loud enough for the few other shoppers to hear. "Can I help you? Just what is it that you want?" The man said nothing. He just kind of tilted his head so as to get a better look at me and actually stepped closer. I hoped I wouldn't have to slap the man as he was a rather pitiful creature, but I was getting wary and enough was enough already. "I'm sorry," he finally croaked. "I hope I'm not troubling you, but would you mind telling me your name?" "What do you want my name for?" I asked. "You look familiar, very familiar to me, and Gibeah is the only place that I've ever lived, and I know practically everybody, and everybody knows me. But you do look familiar, and I can't quite place you." "Well, I'll tell you what. You tell me your name, and we'll see if that compels me to tell you mine." "Oh, absolutely, ma'am. My name is Geroth." I put my hand to my mouth and gasped. "Geroth? Geroth, I can't believe it. Geroth, you were Abner's servant." Now he gasped and stepped back. "Oh, my, Rizpah, it's you." Another old woman, one of the very few in the market, had made it a point to hear every word. She, of course, knew Geroth, and at the sound of my name she also gasped. From that moment, the word was out on the wind. Within a week, Gibeah was abuzz with news of my return and my whereabouts. This news didn't mean nearly as much to the younger generation, but still their interest was piqued because of Gibeah's favorite and most famous son, Saul. Anyone that could give any inside information on the dealings of the kingdom back in those days immediately became somewhat of a celebrity. As for me, I did not want anything to do with any of it. Still, as old acquaintances made their way to my small rented room, it was indeed nice to see them. I could see pain, however, on several faces when they realized what I had been reduced to, but I didn't want their pity. I still carried myself tall, allowed for no stooping, and my hair still had hardly any gray in it. I may have been vain about my dark hair, but I really didn't try to make anything special of it. In the end, I knew that, gray hair or not, the grave would get us all. And what with real famine looming, it would probably be sooner than later. As for my present humble surroundings, I didn't let any of that bother me. I loved the family I rented from, and I especially loved their children. One reason I was going through my shekels so very quickly was that I loved them so much I simply could not stand to see them suffer. As for their parents, Joram and Bethra, when they found out who I was, or actually who I had been, they felt worse than anyone that I'd been reduced to my present circumstances and the pitiful room they were charging me so much for. I kept telling them that I was very happy and not to worry about it, and assured them that I was just thankful to be with their children and glad to be of some help. "Please," I said, "please count me as family. It would be an honor." At that, they all hugged old Aunt Rizzy. Gradually, the novelty of who I had been began to wear off, and the attention began to slacken, and I was very relieved. One day, the family's second-born child, a little boy of 7 named Abishai, yes, after the hooligan nephew of King David, quietly sidled up next to me as I sat outside under an oak tree. He sat very silent and still for a long time. As this was not his usual conduct, I figured something must be up. "Little Ab," that was my name for him, I couldn't bring myself to pronounce his full name, "what can I do for you?" I need to ask you a question," he said, looking down at the ground. "Okay, you just ask away and we'll see if old Aunt Rizzy can help you." "Okay, he whispered. And then, as if trying to screw up his courage, he said, What's a concubine? I sat for a long time, and actually had a slight smile on my face as I tried to figure out exactly what to say. Little Ab was one of the cutest boys I'd ever known, except, of course, for my own little darlings, and the uniqueness of the moment couldn't help but, well, tickle me. Now, had it been my oldest brother's grandson, well, I hate to even think about my answer. "Well, Auntie, what is it?" he asked, disrupting my reverie. "Well, Little Ab, a concubine," I began very slowly, "a concubine is..."
"Is what?"
"Well, first of all, do you know that I was one?" "Yeah, the kids at Yeshiva told me. They said you were King Saul's that you were his best concubine." "Well, I guess I was. Anyway, Little Ab, a concubine is a woman that, well, to be honest, it's a woman that is, well, it's a woman that has every single obligation that a wife has, including raising children and being faithful and working and helping in a man's home, you know, just like a wife does. The only thing is that she is not quite the same. She is not quite a wife, even though she has no right to leave her, to leave the man that she lives with." Here I paused a moment and said, "Does that make any sense to you, Little Ab?"
"Not a bit."
And after a long moment I said, "Well, Little Ab, it doesn't make any sense to me either, and it never has." Then I jumped up and grabbed him by the hands and said, "Little Ab, let's go to the market and just see if it's possible to find you an apple." Little Ab's eyes lit up and off we went. We did manage to find an apple. It was as pitiful an excuse for an apple as one can possibly think, and it was outrageous in price. But, after all, you can't eat half a shekel, and after what he'd been through that day, it was worth it. The next year was shaping itself into a full-blown famine. The cattle and sheep were dying by droves, and the poorer people in certain regions of the nation had begun to die as well. The king of Israel issued a decree that all the people seek God about our dire situation. It was also being said that the new king himself was fasting in an effort to get a hold of God. I thought to myself that now was a good time to fast as ever, for there were very few things edible anyway. I also wondered if anyone, anywhere, was going to be able to get a hold of Israel's God. I wasn't sure if he would listen to any of us anymore, but I sure hoped so. At least, that's what I thought then. Two weeks later, it was Giroth who came and broke the news to me. The news he brought and the subsequent events are what turned me into the old broken woman I am now. The moment I saw him, I knew by the pain in his eyes and his horribly pale face that he was bringing evil, yes, very evil tidings. What he haltingly and at times tearfully related was that the week before, my two precious sons, Armoni and Mephibosheth, had been made prisoners by King David. I leaned on the table and gasped, "But why? What have they done?" And immediately the thought came to me that after all these years, David's true colors were finally coming out, and that after the rebellion of Absalom, he decided to clear the field of any and all possible threats to his precious throne. After all but screaming my thoughts to Giroth, he sadly said, "No, no, my friend, it's not that. It's actually much worse than that." I made myself breathe and forced my frantic mind to listen to the rest of his hideous tale.
Rizpah, King David has been told... Well, he says that God has told him the reason for this terrible famine is because of the bloody house of Saul and for what he did to the Gibeonites. My mind reeled as I knew full well what Giroth was referring to. A few years before he was slain, Saul had slain several thousands of the Gibeonite peoples that heavily populated the southern regions of Israel. These were the Canaanites that Joshua had naively allowed to remain in Israel during the conquest of the land. They had deceived Joshua into making a peace covenant with them after they persuaded him that they lived far beyond the borders of the land promised of God to our father Abraham. Little did Joshua realize that they lived basically over the next hill. Israel, due to their covenant, did not slay them, but made them laborers. And so the Gibeonites had made their abode among Israel for centuries. When King Saul slew the vast majority of these heathen people, he'd done so to make Israel happy. Few Israelis, if any, gave much thought about any promises made by our fathers almost 500 years before. Giroth, you can't be serious, I said. King David saying that this drought and famine are the results of what Saul did to the Gibeonites well over 30 years ago, because he broke promises made over 400 years ago? This just can't be. He's just using it as an excuse to... But Giroth stopped me. Rizpah, it gets worse. I froze. David has turned your two sons, as well as the five sons that Michael the Queen raised for her sister Merab when she died, over to the Gibeonites. Rizpah, they are going to kill them and hang their bodies up on beams they have erected. And King David has agreed to this, and that they are to hang there until the drought breaks. That was when I fainted. When I came to, I was on my small bed being hovered over by Bethra, Giroth, and two more local women that had apparently also heard the news of what David and the Gibeonites were doing and had come to check on my welfare. Standing behind them were two of Bethra's youngest children. She knelt beside me and began to soothingly ask if I was all right. Before I could answer that of course I was not all right, the door burst open and in ran little Ab. He had also heard the news while in yeshiva and had instantly begun running all the way back home to check on his Aunt Rizzi. Due to the children's presence, I was forced to get control of myself and stretched forth a hand in order to be helped up. "No, no, Rizpah, please," began Bethra, "please lie still." But I would not. When I started to get up on my own, they relented and all helped, especially little Ab. When I was finally on my feet, I was dizzy, and the world seemed out of kilter. But then, since Adam's transgression, when was it not? I took a few deep breaths, and then, looking at Giroth, said, "Where are my sons now, this minute? Do you know?" The room grew still as a tomb, and the only sound I heard was the beating of my mad heart. Losing all my forced control, I screamed, "Where are my babies?" The looks on their faces and the tears that began to run down their cheeks told me everything, and what little mercy I seemed to receive from God that hideous day. I fainted once more. The next day, I went to my sons. The Gibeonites, true to their word, had hung the bodies of my two sons and Michael's sons, actually Merab's, onto large beams that they had placed within eyesight of Saul's old palace. It was no longer a palace, obviously, but a well-tended manor owned by Jonathan's son, Mephibosheth. This same Mephibosheth was named after my son, who is dead, and hanging a mere 150 yards away. I began a little before noon, with the help of Joram, to make my way to see my sons. From Joram's all but dead farm to my old palace home was about 3 miles away. We had no horse, nor mule, nor ass to ride. The animals had been given away as we could not afford to feed them. No one was willing to buy them, and we were unwilling to eat them. So we walked, and for the first time in my life, I found myself having to physically lean on someone. It was a new experience for me, but then I knew all experiences from this day forward were going to be, in some way, new. My world was being forever changed. As we walked, my eyes were glued to the earth before me. This was also something new for me, as I had ever been so alert, the curious, interested one. Now I couldn't seem to raise my head, as I feared that whatever I saw would be gruesome. I realized that we must be getting close to my sons, for Joram had a sudden intake of breath. I lifted my head, but could see nothing amiss. I looked to Joram and saw that his eyes were looking up into the air. When I did the same, I saw the buzzards circling in the distance. Joram gave my hand a hard, long squeeze, and we reluctantly continued. After perhaps another 100 yards, I felt Joram tremble ever so slightly. I lifted my eyes from the road once again, and in the distance I could see a crowd of people looking up at 7 poles and the 7 bodies that hung from them. I felt my legs grow weak and felt Joram hold me even more securely. "Rizpah," he quietly said, "we don't have to do this. We can stop here. We've seen enough. We can turn around." "No," I croaked, and made myself once again put 1 foot in front of the other. We slowly made it past the entrance to Mephibosheth's lands and the beautiful home where I had lived for so many years ago. How strange it was that in the face of the single greatest tragedy of my life, this place could still affect me so. But I guess that was to be expected. Both of my now dead sons were born into this mad world in that royal house. How strange also that my son's namesake should now own this house. It was nothing short of a miracle that Mephibosheth received it, and another miracle that he still had it, though half of this once vast estate was now lost and would never be returned to the house of Saul. King David, after having given all of Saul's lands to Mephibosheth, later divided the land and gave half to the old wretch Ziba, King Saul's former servant. David divided the lands after the Absalom rebellion. Ziba and his 15 all but rotten sons had convinced David that Mephibosheth had hoped to parlay Absalom's fiasco into a return of Israel to the house of Saul, and that Mephibosheth himself surmised that he could somehow end up as king of Israel. How David could ever fall for a line like that, especially from the mouth of scum like Ziba, is beyond me. But then, even a man like Joshua had once been deceived by the Gibeonites. That's what he got for simply not asking God if they were lying. At any rate, Mephibosheth now owned half of what Saul had once owned, but he didn't really seem to care. As long as David was king and not Absalom, Mephibosheth seemed truly content. He really did seem to love David, as did his father Jonathan. It's hard to believe that Mephibosheth loved David. How could anyone in this world love David? How could even God love David? And David, how could you, you that had once been so kind to me, and who wrote such beautiful songs, and who could do so many seemingly good things, how could you just allow the heathen to murder, maim, and hang my darlings from poles? I determined that someday I would ask David if he even bothered to ask God what he wanted him to do, or if he simply left it all up to the heathen Gibeonites. At this moment, I knew that I had to pray, or that I'd begin to lose my mind. God, please help me. You know that I've always wanted just to be a good woman. But you know the deep bitterness that's being brewed in my soul. And God, you know I dare not truly hate my king. But dear God, right now, I would have a hard time spitting on David if he was engulfed in flames, which I hope he soon will be. As we kept walking, I began to hear the wails of the women that had gathered at the side of this grotesque tragedy. I have, sad to say, been to the funerals of many, many people. I've been to some of the largest that Israel has ever hosted, the largest probably being Samuel's. I'll never forget that funeral. We were all surprised, we concubines, that is, that Saul allowed us to go, but Shaliah and I figured out later that he just wanted us to hear him wax eloquent concerning his old friend and mentor, the prophet Samuel. At any rate, I know the wailing of funeral lamentations very well, both the real and the hired. To the untrained ear, it all sounds the same. But if you are an Israelite and are allowed to live past the age of 40, you can often pick up on the difference. How to describe that certain intangible something that constitutes for a truly, utterly, completely sincere wail, I do not know. Perhaps it is somehow discerning the difference between that which emanates only from the body, however agonized and painful it may be, and sensing that certain special something which can emanate only from the very inner depth of the soul of a man, or especially a woman. It is that component that comes from a part of a human being that we really know so very little about, but which ultimately is the inner core of our very life force. When this inner, deep-down part of a human being meets with utter, absolute hopelessness, with a seemingly never-ending agony of a loss that they are absolutely positive will never be completely healed in this life, and that certainty, that knowledge is totally absorbed into the soul of a man, on a scale and a depth that was previously not known to exist, then there is a certain immutable sound, a type of wail that you know you will never, ever forget as long as you live. On this day, as I approached the destroyed bodies of sons that I had delivered into this world, nourished from my own body, washed and cleansed and held and loved and rocked and pampered and comforted when hurt or frightened or wounded or upset or disappointed or hungry or sleepy or a thousand other things, when I saw my dead sons hanging on these trees and their bloodied bodies and Mephibosheth's wide staring eyes and Armoni's wide open mouth, as well as the five other hapless creatures that Michael, David's wife, had raised, I knew that the wail I felt coming up and out of me was going to stagger even these utterly and sincere and vanquished women. And so I, Rizpah, the mother of Armoni and Mephibosheth, erupted into savage, strangled, and seemingly endless screams of death and despair. The wail that emanated out of me for the next 30 minutes brought every single standing man and woman to their knees, and many to their faces. And so, finally, after all these years, the once tall and beautiful Rizpah, the statuesque and all but black-haired Rizpah, was now completely and forever gone, never ever to return. The following morning, I was still sitting and rocking and weeping and groaning. Joram pleaded with me to leave, but on my part that was never even a consideration. As it was springtime and chill was still in the air, some thoughtful men, before they retreated to their homes, had started a fire and gathered a great quantity of wood to keep burning through the night. As word got out how bad it really was with me, people began to drop by, feed the fire, and leave water, wine, bread, fruit, all of which was so desperately needed by each of them. While I didn't turn the gifts away, I didn't eat them either. To have refused the food, I would have had to speak. And I wasn't sure if Rizpah would ever be able to speak again. Rizpah could only weep and wail. Finally, Joram had no choice but to return to his home. Within 2 hours, Bethra had come and taken his place. 4 women, all but one being over 60 years of age, spent the entire night with me. When the daylight appeared, first one, then another, would begin to force their exhausted bodies to rise and make the trek back to their homes where they were needed. But these were soon replaced by others who came to comfort the grief-stricken old Rizpah that refused to leave her sons. These also brought what little food they could spare. But when they saw the uneaten food not 2 feet from me, they, when they had to leave, would take their food back to their deprived families. And though I felt bad for them, throughout that day, evening, night, and morning, I could not bring myself to utter a single sensible word to any of them. By the second hour of that day, the buzzards returned. I finally took a drink of water about noon, and while doing so, noticed that the birds were becoming bolder. 4 or 5 of them had landed and were about 50 feet on the other side of the bodies of my sons. They did not seem to be staring at them, but rather at me. It was then that it dawned on me that they were simply waiting for me to leave. Furthermore, it dawned on me that throughout the night, while in my trance of tears, I had heard the sounds of a howling wolf. So that was how it was to be, a battle of wills between a mother and beasts. What had happened to these my sons was in Israel the most ignominious form of death. To be thrown to the elements and nature's beasts without proper burial was the height of defamation. This is why Goliath and David both hurled their statements to each other that they were going to give their flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. One just doesn't go any lower than that. And yet this is what David was allowing to happen to my sons, and to the sons that his wife had raised upon the very sad death of their natural mother. My sons were to be left to be eaten by vultures during the day and by the beasts at night, and what they didn't get, rot would. And there my sons were to remain, unburied, until the rains, if ever, came. Mephibosheth, not my Mephibosheth, but Jonathan's Mephibosheth, the namesake of the now stiffened and frozen in death caricature up on the beam that that used to be my little boy did not actually live in the house his grandfather Saul had built. He lived almost continually in Jerusalem and ate at King David's table. In this time of famine, that was not a bad idea. Mephibosheth had one son named Micah who lived in the former palace house. That is, Micah lived there when he was not in Jerusalem conducting business for himself and for his lame father. He had not been here when the Gibeonites slew and hung up my sons. Now, in the distance behind me, I thought I heard the sound of horses' hooves and of men talking. Though I did not turn and look, and had absolutely no desire to do so, I wondered if perhaps Micah and the leaders of his estate, what was left of it, had come home. I wondered if they would come over to where Rizpah was, to get a good look at her sons. In my tortured mind, I had begun to refer to all seven of these grim corpses as my sons. Soon, I thought it might be said, "Ah, Rizpah has adopted five sons late in life. And yes, have you heard? She's searching the sepulchres to see if she can find them some wives." On and on, macabre scenes and conversations began to play themselves out in my tortured mind. I realized that I was coming close, but I did not get firm hold of myself, to sliding down the sodden path to madness. So, for the first time in many hours, I stood to my feet. I had sat so long that to do so was as if I were prying apart boards that had been nailed together. But stand I did, and turned. There, sitting behind me, about 10 feet away, were two women. One was on her side, turned away from the sun and apparently asleep. The other was sitting upright, with her eyes half open, in some kind of exhaustion-produced, trance-like state. Both were dressed in expensive, very well-made garments, and as it was still the month Abib, had knitted travel shawls over their shoulders. I did notice, however, that the woman who was sitting wore clothes that were quite a bit more expensive than the others. I looked back, and could see a carriage down the way with a driver lying in the back seat. I also could see that the horses I had heard were indeed at Mephibosheth's house, and that a number of men were simply standing and staring in our direction. I picked up the water bottle that someone had left for me, and with a sound of stiff joints snapping, I walked to the woman who seemed as if she were under a spell. I had to nudge her with the bottle before she realized I was there. She looked up, instantly began to tear up, and asked, "Rizpah, oh my beautiful Rizpah, are you going to be okay?" I bent over to look closely into her face. She was a wizened old woman, possibly in her late 70s, and rather heavy in spite of the famine. This woman obviously knew me, but I could not place her. She probably did not live in the surrounding area, or we'd have most likely met each other by now. After a few moments of intensely staring into each other's face, I said, "I'm so sorry, but do I know you?" "Ah, my beautiful Rizpah, the years have taken such a toll on me. I am Shaliah." Instantly, I dropped to my knees where we fell into each other's arms and began to sob. It was my old and trusted friend and my fellow concubine to our husband, to King Saul. It was not what you could call a great setting for catching up on old times, but in spite of the atmosphere of gloom and pain, we managed to do so. Shaliah talked slowly for the next several hours, every now and then stopping to look up at the beams. Then we'd both cry for a while. After a while, she would resume her narrative. What her narrative boiled down to was basically this, When we had parted company upon David's ascension to the throne of all Israel, Jeliah had gone to live with and marry a widower named Uri, who had known her when they were both in their teens and had hoped to marry her. When her indolent farmer father had used her to pay off his debts, Uri was heartbroken, but nevertheless married within a year. After his wife died decades later, Uri, knowing, of course, that King Saul was long dead, had sent word to her that he had never forgotten her. This was what she had meant when she stated to me that she would be okay. And she really had been, and still was. Her husband, who had become a house builder for the rich, and had therefore become pretty wealthy himself, was still alive, though he had weakened greatly in the last few years. So here was my old friend, who after all these years was living back in her hometown of Jabesh-Gilead. She had come all this long way to comfort me in my time of greatest sorrow. When I began to fully fathom what all this had to have entailed, I asked Jeliah, But how did you get here so quickly? And how did you even hear about this? My husband, though he has become somewhat weak, cannot give up working. He oversees the jobs and does very little of the actual labor. He has several men who work for him, who are, well, honey, they're Gibeonites. She must have seen me stiffen, for she squeezed my hand a little tighter and said, "There, there, honey, please remember that these are not all bad people, any more than the Israelites are all good people. You know when Joshua made them servants all those centuries ago? He made them, among other things, into sawers of wood. Well, honey, through the centuries they have become great craftsmen and carpenters, and my husband has used them for years. Actually, when Saul began slaughtering the Gibeonites, many of them fled to our part of the country. That's when my husband began using their building skills. After Uri and I were married and these Gibeonites found out that I had been Saul's, well, you know what we were to Saul, and they were terrified of me. It took me a long time to win them over. Well, anyway, throughout all of this day's storytelling, it came back to me how much Jeliah loved to talk. I always thought that one of the reasons she had so readily befriended me upon my arrival in Gibeah was that I was one of the few who was willing to listen to her. They finally realized that I was not going to, I guess, have them killed or something. Well, anyway, these people are real tight with each other and keep in close contact all around the nation, especially since Saul did what he did, and they watch out for each other's backs. Well, when David called in the Gibeonites that lived in Jerusalem and told them what God had told him, well, you know, anyway, when that happened, word spread throughout the Gibeonites like fire. They actually had couriers riding the fastest horses they could get their hands on from one Gibeonite settlement to another to get their opinion as to what they ought to tell David. Thinking what the Gibeonites had decided David should do, we looked upon my son's bodies and held each other and sobbed. The woman who had been sleeping on the ground was one of Shaliah's house servants, who had traveled with her and had been listening to us as well to Jeliah for some time. Upon this last outburst of tears, she came and knelt down, embraced us both, and cried with us. After a while, we all wiped our noses and eyes, and Jeliah continued. Well, my husband immediately knew something big was up due to the fact that none of the Gibeonites showed up for work that they were doing on a very large house. When he asked them the next day about their absence, they became very quiet and wouldn't respond. He then sent them all to work and took their foreman aside and began to question him. As soon as Uri realized what was up, he had his carriage driver bring him home so he could tell me. And, well, Rizpah, I had no idea where you were, but I knew exactly where you were going to be. So, I came to be with my beautiful friend. We wept some more until I heard someone clear their throat behind us. We composed ourselves once more and turned around to see who was there. As I turned, I noticed the vultures that had been landing, walking about, staring at us and flying off simply to return again. We're now 15 feet closer to my sons. Then I looked to see who had now come to this scene of horror. Shelia and I were halfway to our feet when we both froze and gaped. Who it was that stood before us literally took our breath away. There, not 10 feet away, stood the image of King Saul, as we had first met him years and years ago. I knew I had lost my mind. The specter smiled ruefully at us and began to speak while looking at me. "Are you Rizpah?" "Yes," I said, shaken and straightening, though I did not stand as straight as I had the day before yesterday. "First," the scepter continued, "I want to say that there are no words in our language to express my father's and my deepest, deepest sympathy. Rizpah, we are truly very sorry." This, I realized, was no ghost, but must be Micah, Mephibosheth's son and King Saul's great-grandson. I could now see that he was not nearly as tall as Saul had been, merely a head taller than most men, not head and shoulders taller. And God help me, but I instantly thought that if the Gibeonite people had laid their eyes on this man and had known how much he looked like King Saul, he alone would be hanging on a beam behind me. Shelia and I were still speechless for so long that the already dour atmosphere was becoming tense as well. But Micah soon dispelled it. "Rizpah, my father is Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul. My father remembers but very little of his father and nothing at all of King Saul. But I have been often told that I look a lot like my grandfather. As you knew King Saul very well, I had hoped not to shock you today. As I see that I have, I apologize again, and very sincerely." I still did not know quite what to say. That the events of the last 3 days had overwhelmed my heart and mind was an understatement. But just a moment ago, I had wondered again if I was slipping into madness, like this young man's great-grandmother Ahinoam had done. To her great credit, Shelia stepped in and took over, as she had always been wont to do. "Well, son, if you're handing out apologies, I think you owe me one as well. I am Shelia, and I knew Saul just as well, and in fact quite a bit longer than Rizpah." Micah's eyes grew very big, and he said, "You are Shelia? King Saul's concubine? In the very flesh, at least what's left of me, which as you can see is actually quite a bit. And by the way, there were 5 of us concubines all together, plus your great-grandmother. She was actually his wife." And then she smiled. Though my friend was now old and wrinkled, her smile was as infectious as it had ever been. And, except for the sorrow that was hanging in our hearts at my back, we all would have no doubt laughed. Micah did not laugh, but I could tell he wanted to. He smiled broadly to Shelia and bowed, saying, "Then to you, Shelia, I also very deeply apologize for startling you, and pray I did not offend you." Then, looking again at me, he said, "Rizpah, though my words may assuage but little of your pain, I want you to know that everyone here and every Israelite's heart goes out to you and to all your family. Please remember, though I may not have known them, or at least not known them very well, these men," here he lifted his head and looked at my sons, "are my kinsmen, and I'm sure you realize that I, and especially my father, could easily be there with your sons. "Why are you not?" I asked. He winced slightly at my brusque question, but never missed a beat. The young man was actually much more suave and articulate than his great-grandfather, and seemingly more kind. "My father and I are not with our kinsmen, because the Gibeonites required 7 men of Saul's house, not 9, and because King David entered into covenant with Jonathan that he would always remember to show kindness to his house. That is the only reason that I am not hanging there, along the side of your dead sons." Again, before I thought, I said, "Well, had I known how powerful and ruthless our little Prince David was going to turn out to be, I'd have entered into covenant with him as well." Micah reddened somewhat, but whether in shame or anger I could not tell. His features revealed nothing. Whatever he was feeling, he said, "Rizpah, I cannot fathom the pain and sorrow that your heart is engulfed in. Again, most everything I have to say to you today can be taken only as words that, when compared to the deeds done here, may seem as nothing. Regardless, my father told me that he has personally never seen King David's palace so steeped in gloom as it is this day. There are tears flowing everywhere within the palace, almost from every eye, including and especially from David's. From the day that Queen Michael heard what was going to take place, she has talked to no one, not even her most trusted and lifetime servant Zora, who, by the way, has also been thrown into a grievous abyss of grief. I say this only to let you know that there are others that share your pain. Again, I know that these are merely words, but please trust me, you have never heard any truer words spoken in your life." Then he paused and pressed on. "My father, who obviously abhors this and wishes that it never happened, is also sick that this foul deed has taken place on his property. Be that as it may, he knew that you would be here and has instructed me to tell you that you have free access to his home and anything else he possesses. He will personally be here in a day or two, but as I am sure you can understand, it is not as easy for my father to travel as it is for most." I stared at this young man, this young Saul, for a long time, then dropped my eyes, told him I was sorry for any hurtful thing I had uttered, then fell into Shaliah's waiting arms and sobbed. We both cried. We wept for my babies. We wept for Michael and her babies. We wept for the entire sick, pain-filled world in which we were forced to live. I eventually asked the patient Micah if he could please station a man near the beams while I went to the house where I'd given birth to my sons to somewhat refresh myself. 3 men immediately did so, chasing away the buzzards which had moved even closer to my sons. Shaliah, her servant, and I went to our old home. It was amazing to us how much it had changed and how much it was exactly the same. We were flooded with so many memories that neither could speak. Presently, Shaliah went her way, her servant girl in tow, to ruminate with her ghosts, and I went my way. A servant of Micah's discreetly followed each of us in our attempts to revive ourselves. After washing up, straightening my hair somewhat, and noticing several brand new gray hairs, and eating a little, I visited the rooms that I had lived in so very long ago. I looked out the window where I had enjoyed the view so many thousands of times, and there, in the distance, I saw the vultures circling over my sons. I tearfully turned, left, and went to the rooms that Abner had given me. They really were beautiful rooms and obviously still inhabited by a woman. No doubt these now belonged to Micah's wife, based on the beautiful clothing in the very large closet. I wondered where she was, and then thought that she, no doubt, was still in Jerusalem, or on her way from there, possibly coming with Mephibosheth. I hoped she wouldn't mind, but I sat on her bed that was in the exact same spot that it had been in when this room was mine. For just a moment, I thought I'd see if it was as comfortable as the one I used to sleep on, and lay back with my head on the pillow. I looked up to the ceiling, thought of Saul, thought of Abner, thought of my sons, began to cry, and fell asleep. I awoke with a start and found myself trying to remember where I was. For a moment, I was back 30 years before in the beautiful room that Abner had given me, and I was waiting for him. And then I heard again the sound that had wakened me, and instantly I knew exactly where I was. I was still in my nightmare, and the sound was that of a howling wolf, and it was dark outside. I threw off the blanket that someone had covered me with, found my sandals that had been removed from my feet, and ran down the stairs and out the front door. And I continued to run as fast as my old and breaking down body would allow, toward my sons. Thankfully, I could see that someone had started another fire. That was good, yes, very good, because it would help keep the beasts away. As I drew nearer, I could make out what looked to be two men sitting not too far from the fire. When they heard me coming, it must have startled them, for they jumped quickly to their feet and were looking my way. I found that I had to quit running and try to catch my breath. I also realized that one man held a club in his hand, and that the other had a bow with an arrow already strung, ready if needed. When they saw that it was just the old mother of the deceased, they visibly relaxed. I could now make out that these were very young men, perhaps in their late teens. What with the ghoulish scene in front of them and the darkness surrounding them, the wolves and their howling, and the sound of my running, I could understand their nervousness. When I finally arrived and walked past the fire to look up at my sons, I was shocked at what just one day more had done to them. What with their gaunt faces, withering limbs, seeping body fluids, and the flickering firelight, it was indeed the stuff that nightmares were made of. And it was my babies. I began to weep. I found that my crying had taken on a somewhat different feel. It didn't quite flow as readily, as powerfully. It was as if I had come to the place that I was beginning to cry myself out. And at that moment, I began to feel an icy determination work its way into my soul, and I knew what I had to do, and knew what I would do. I turned to the boys and said, "I take it that you are servants to Mephibosheth?" "Well, yes, more actually to Micah. Not that it matters all that much," said the taller of the two. "Have you been here long?" "Maybe 3-4 hours," said the other. "How long has it been dark?" I asked. "About the same. We started our shift at sundown. Micah told us that if anything happened that it would go very bad with us, because it would really bother." "I understand," I said. "Thank you for everything you're doing. Has there been any problems with the animals?" The shorter of the boys now seemed to be taking the lead in answering. "Yes, well, as you can tell, the wolves are out, and we've heard some jackals as well. But, well, this afternoon the vultures were really starting to get bold, and a couple of the men who were watching your sons literally had to chase them away. He shot one with an arrow. The other birds will probably start on him tomorrow." As he finished, his voice had grown pretty low, and he was looking at the ground. His actions were no doubt based on how this news had affected my countenance. I drew a deep breath and again told them that I appreciated all they were doing. I also said, "Well, here I am now, and it's okay for you to leave. I will be here for the rest of the night." The boys looked at me and at each other and then back to me. "We were told to stay here." "For how long?" I asked. "Till about midnight. Then Micah was sending someone else to take over." "Boys," I said, "these are my sons hanging here. Well, two of them are. And I'm going to take care of all of them till this is over. I know that from time to time I will have to have help, but I am the one that brought them into the world, and until they are properly buried, I am their mother, and I will continue to take care of them. But please do this for me. In the morning, tell Micah that I need to speak to him. Now, is there any food and water here?" "Yes, ma'am, right there. There's not a lot of food anywhere, as you know, but they gave us some barley bread, corn kernels, a jug of water, and a skin of wine." "One more thing. Have you seen my friend Shaliah?" "No, ma'am. I think she must be as tired as you were." Then suddenly we stopped talking, for among the trees, less than 50 yards beyond my sons, we heard the growling of the jackals. My resolve was renewed. I went and took a good drink from the jug, a barley loaf from the basket, and sat down on the other side of the fire. After another hour, I noticed that the boys, the young men, had gone to sleep. I arose and, as quietly as possible, placed more wood on the fire. Then I covered the boys' shoulders with their cloaks, picked up the tall boy's club, and returned to my spot. I didn't sit down just yet. I walked over to my eldest son, Armoni, and reached my hand up to touch his foot. I found myself squeezing it for a minute or two, then walked over to Mephibosheth and did the same. Both of my son's feet were covered with dried blood and were cold and beginning to feel like stone. I then, because I had taken care of Michael's adopted sons, went to each of them and did the same. I don't know if it did any good for them, but I prayed for each of them and then their wives and children, if indeed they each had families. Then and there, I adopted Michael's boys as my own. I only wish it could have happened before they were dead. I also promised each one of them that until they received a proper burial, not one of them would be touched by the fowls of the air or the beasts of the field. Their mother, who had not been able to stave off their unjust deaths from the hands of unjust men, would at least stave off the ignominy of them finally being devoured by beasts. That was when I found out that I still had many, many tears left in me. The next morning, the vultures lifted off their perches from the nearby trees to renew their pursuit, and my sons begin to smell. Shaliah left 2 days later after I persuaded her to go back to her husband and home. I had no doubt that the smell and growing gruesomeness helped to make her decision. Also, the town people that had been dropping by began to come less and less. This was to be expected, and I took no offense from it. I had worse problems than that. As for Joram and Bethra, one or the other made it a point to come every day for at least a couple of hours. On the third day, I asked Bethra if it were possible for her to bring me a large piece of sackcloth. I told her where my few remaining shekels were hidden in order to purchase it, and told her to use the rest on her family as needed. When she began to desist on spending even a farthing of my money, I told her how Micah was providing for my needs. When she still refused, I told her, "Okay, keep track of what you spend and we'll let it go toward my rent on my return." Then Bethra said, "But oh, Rizpah, you won't be come." And then she caught herself, took a quick glance at my sons, and began to cry on my shoulder as I held her close. We both knew, everyone knew, that it would be a long time before the rains returned to Israel, if ever again. After a while, she began to make her long trek home. The next day, at dusk, a very tired Joram brought me my sackcloth. Micah was there when Joram arrived, and upon realizing Joram's and Bethra's plight, as well as their love for me, not only lent them a mule to travel on, but gave them an omer of barley and a sack of corn kernels. It was then that I told Micah that another important kindness he could perform would be to send word to my sons' wives that on no wise should they come here, and no matter what, do not bring or allow any of the children to come. They needed to remember their fathers as they were in life, not as they were now, and certainly not what they were rapidly becoming. When I asked if he could possibly do the same for Michael's sons, he slowly replied that, "I am sure that has already been taken care of." At the questioning look on my face, he said, "Rizpah, I hope you don't mind, but upon his request, I send the king a report every couple of days. When I explained how bad it was here, he took it upon himself to tell the families." After staring at Micah a long time, I simply said, "That was nice of the king," and turned and walked back to my station and to my sackcloth. That evening, an expensive-looking carriage arrived and stopped a short distance away. A lone figure began to slowly make his way to the scene of sorrow. I figured by the appearance of the carriage and the fine horses that pulled it that most likely someone had come from Jerusalem and probably from the palace. Someone was helped down from the carriage, and as they approached, I could now make out that it was a woman. Based on her stooped condition and slow walk, I thought that she was either aged or grieving or both. As she approached the firelight, I recognized her, but could not remember her name. Then it came to me as I remembered Micah speaking to me of her sorrow. It was Zorah, Queen Michael's old and trusted servant. The closer she came and the more she could see, the slower became her approach. I could now see that she was staggering under the immensity of horror before her. I arose, went to her, and helped her to complete the last dozen yards of her pilgrimage. Neither she nor I spoke a word. When we came to my small camp, I saw that she did not intend to stop there. She continued going forward while leaning more and more heavily upon me. We made our way to where she could look up into the faces of the boys she had helped to raise. Knowing Michael as I did, I felt sure that this grieving woman had a much larger part in raising these men than most people realized. Still, we spoke nothing to each other, but the touch of our bodies and grief of our soul said everything that needed to be said. Then, this woman of so many long, hard years as a servant to Michael, King Saul's daughter, turned to me, fell into my arms, and piteously wept. After a while, when she had somewhat gathered herself together, she also went about touching the feet of the boys she loved, and my son's feet as well. Then we returned to my spot of vigilance and lowered ourselves to the ground. I continued to keep an arm around her, and she continued to shed tears with her head upon my shoulder. When she finally was able to stop crying, she managed to say, "Rizpah, please forgive me. I should be holding you." "It's okay, Zorah. No doubt you have had to be strong in so many ways for so many reasons. Well, it's your turn now. With that, she sobbed and renewed her tears. That night, Zora related to me her and Michael's experience of our now common nightmare. When she told me of the sacrificial offerings that had been offered to God for my sons, Armoni and Mephibosheth, I could not believe my ears and wept at the tale. From that day, I always made it a point to touch Mehelliped's feet especially tenderly. As daylight began to break, Zora spoke again. "Rizpah, I have to go now. I have to go back and, well, explain to Michael what it's like here and what's happening. I understand. Thank you, Rizpah. I thank you from my soul for what you're doing," she said in between newly erupting tears. To that I said nothing. Zora continued, "Rizpah, please don't think that because Michael has not and will not be coming that she doesn't care." I said nothing, for there was nothing relevant to say. "Please, Rizpah, please keep this to yourself. But I'm not sure that Michael's going to make it through this." "Zora," I replied, "it's yet to be seen that any of us are going to actually make it through this." "I know," is all she said. I walked her back to the carriage, and the driver helped her up and shut the door behind her. He then went to the back of the carriage and began to take a crate, which no doubt held some food, back to my campsite. From inside the carriage, I heard Zora call my name, and I answered, "Yes," and return. "Rizpah, I am going to tell Michael not to come." I said nothing. "Part of the reason I'm here is to see, well, to see if she should or should not come." I said nothing. "Rizpah, she would not be able to handle this. Not Michael, not in 1,000 lifetimes." I said nothing. I then saw Zora sit up and look out of the carriage to see just where the driver was. When she could see that he was a distance away, approaching the camp carrying the box, she said, "Rizpah, Michael will never, ever forgive David for this." I absolutely said nothing. "Rizpah, I know the king. He would never have allowed this had he not known that it simply must be. It was the payment the Gibeonites demanded." I said nothing, and she sat back into her seat, staring dazedly ahead. After a few more moments, the driver came back and climbed up into his seat. He looked down at me to see if Zora and I had finished our conversation. He then raised the reins and was about to drive off, when I placed my hand on the carriage door and said, "Zora?" "Yes?" "Please tell Michael, well, tell her that she was allowed to adopt her boys in life, and that, if it's any comfort, I have adopted them in death." I heard her croak, "I will. Thank you, Rizpah." After another few seconds of silence, the driver snapped the reins, and Zora, servant of Michael, adoptive mother of my dead adopted sons, was carried away. Since that day, I have probably lost 40 pounds that I did not need to lose. The last time I went to Micah's house, which was about a week ago, I looked in a mirror and saw that my hair is now completely white. When I go to the house, I also find that it takes me twice as long to get there and to come back. I cannot, under any circumstances, run anymore. Even my walking days, I fear, are almost over. As for my sons, They all have lost all of the weight they ever possessed, except for the weight of their brittle and peeling skin, and the weight of their bones. I noticed that Armoni still has one tuft of hair that somehow tenaciously clings on the back of his skull. But then, Armoni's hair was always very thick, like Saul his father's, and like Micah his great-nephew's. It has now been 5 months. Actually, everyone, everywhere in Israel, has probably lost weight. The famine has seen very well to that, thank you. But those closest to me in my nightmare have all been deeply affected. Joram, who still comes every other day, looks nearly as gaunt as did my Mephibosheth after his first week of death. Bethra is in a little better shape, but not much. Even strong, handsome Micah looks as if he has aged 10, maybe 20 years. But his suffering is also due to the great load he carries concerning his weakening father. Never a strong man physically, how could he be without the use of his feet? Mephibosheth has taken my calamity as his own. Since he arrived at his home mid-morning of day 7 and saw his cousins and witnessed my determination to protect my son's dead bodies, it's as if emotionally he's been thunderstruck. Of course, he offered, as did Micah, the use of all his servants to keep back the fowls and beasts from the bodies of our family. But other than those moments when I simply could not stay with them, I took it on as my sole responsibility. I, after all, am their mother. Why this precious man has taken these boys' fate so personally and so hard, I'm just not sure. Perhaps it is due to the fact that he has lived almost his entire life in the suspense of vulnerability. Now, yet once again, he realizes how close he came to dying, and realizing also that David's hand had seemingly kept him alive. That David's same hand had condemned his cousins to death was nerve-wracking, to say the least. But, be that as it may, this precious man Mephibosheth has been precious to me. Every single day, for well over a month, Mephibosheth had one of his servants bring him in his cart to sit with me for far too long. I tried every kind way to dissuade him from coming, for the toll it was exacting on him was tremendous and obvious. Finally, I played my cruelest hand, just to make him stop, for his sake. When Mephibosheth would come, I refused to talk to him about anything. After 4 days, he quit coming. No one can stand that much mistreatment. After, when he'd leave for the day, I'd cry for being so mean. I didn't know what else to do, and when he quit coming, I cried over wounding him and over my being lonely for him. I should have let him just come, for now he just sits in his house, day after day in grievous mourning, while I sit outside his house in grievous mourning, and we're both pining away. But not as bad as my sons are. I pray my dear friend will be okay. I awoke this morning to find one of Micah's servants sitting on the ground next to me. Whenever I finally pass out, on my sackcloth, one of them will come and sit next to me until I awake. Then, after asking after my welfare, within 5 to 10 minutes they will quietly leave me to continue my vigil. Today makes day 163, and the all but skeletons of my sons remain before me, as they have been, every day. There is virtually nothing left of them now. Though the vultures still fly overhead and sometimes land, I know they have no more interest in my sons than they do the beams that support their bones. No, it is I that have become the subject of their interest. The same is also true of the beasts of the night. Whereas I protected my sons, and will do so until they are buried. For quite some time, the servants of Mephibosheth and Micah have been protecting me. Oh, they keep a discreet distance, but I know that they're there, and they make sure I know, just in case I pass out. I took note that the rising sun has been blocked by clouds. There were many times in the horrific drought that men would be excited over the sight of clouds, but no more. There have been simply far, far too many dry, excruciatingly dry, cloudy days. It was as if the famine was making it a point to wrench the last drop of hope and faith out of Israel by tormenting us with clouds. So, this day was no exception. I did not get excited, nor did I die. I just looked at the clouds and looked at my son's bones. I ate half a barley loaf around noontime. I do not even know where Mephibosheth can purchase barley now, let alone wheat, but somehow he finds a way. The water has become just as precious, though I'm very careful to drink but little. The reason I only eat half is so that I'll have the other half for supper later in the day. I do this so that when I finally pass out, sometime tonight or in the earliest of the morning hours, there will be a small barley loaf for whoever comes to sit by me. They will never, ever touch it until I awake, just enough to realize that I passed out and that they are there, and then I will press it into their hand and go back to sleep for perhaps another half hour. Often I know that they will not eat it, but will take it back to their quarters and give pieces of it to their children. I know that they need the bread very bad themselves, but as one told me, if you can do what you are doing for your sons who are gone, this is the least I can do for my sons who are living. It is late afternoon, and the clouds are darker now, darker than they were yesterday or the day before when they did their dance and played their cruel games. I sit and stare at my sons. Were it not for knowing where they were placed upon which beam, I could no longer tell them apart, not even Armoni and Mephibosheth. It has been a long time, perhaps even 2 weeks, since I have been able to bring myself to touch them. I simply cannot bear it. It's not that I love my babies any less. In fact, the bond that has been established over these past 5 months has somehow taken on dimensions that the tongue finds impossible to express. And to be honest, in my heart I know that if ever I am able to express what has taken place in my heart for all 7 of these boys, I will know that I am officially insane. I somehow rise to my feet. Standing is a much, much slower process now than it was in the early stages of this nightmare, when I felt it was like pulling boards apart that had been nailed together. Now I just pull them loose, but not completely apart, for I am now officially very old and bent and broken in my body and in my spirit and in my heart. One day as I arose, one of the servants ran to help me. That was when I screamed at him. I screamed loud enough that all the servants stopped and watched, and no one has ever had the temerity to try to help me since. I just want to die and go be with my sons and my parents and Abner and even King Saul. I make my feet take some steps and realize that even in my wretched condition, I am still better off than poor Mephibosheth up there in the palace that his great-grandfather built. He has to be carried if he's to move anywhere, and he's been that way since he was 5 years old. I Make my way first to the bones of Arfad. I reach up and place my hand on his foot and begin to pray for my poor, sweet, adopted son, who I never knew, but whom I deeply love. I then do the same for Zeluhed, then Kaldemesh, then Irani and Meheliped. Then I make my way to my second-born son, Mephibosheth. He's the one that the crippled man in the palace was named after, and the son that dispelled my shame and who I love so deeply. Then I slowly make my way to my first-born son, Armoni, whose father was Saul, the first king of the nation of Israel, anointed to be so by no less a personage than the great prophet Samuel. I hold on to this boy's foot, at least what used to be his foot, and I pray. Great Jehovah God, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, God of Moses, and Joshua, and Samuel, and of Saul, and I begin to cry. And God, O great God of David, the giant killer and sweet psalmist of Israel, O God, please have mercy on us all. Then I feel a drop of rain as it lands on the old broken-down hand that holds my son's foot. Then I feel another, then another. And then, the rains come. Three days later, a company of David's men arrive from Jerusalem. They take down the bodies of my sons and me and Mephibosheth and Micah to the sepulchre of Kish, King Saul's father, in the land of Zelah in Benjamin. The following day, more men arrive from Jabesh-Gilead carrying the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan. Mephibosheth begins to weep. With them are Shaliah and her husband Uri. It is there in that place that all my sons and their fathers are finally buried. The land has finally been entreated. The drought and famine are over, and Israel thrives yet again. As for me, I live in the palace that King Saul built, and I am old and broken and white-headed. And I just want to be remembered as a good woman, not a beautiful one.